cliffcentral.com.
Professor Ben Anderson was part of the Audit Committee on the Council for Higher Education between 2010 and 2015. He's been part of the CHE 20-year review team responsible for reviewing higher education in South Africa all the way since 1994, in terms of looking at that. He's also been part of the RPL working group of the SAQA and the review of the role of RPL in higher education and training in the future of South Africa. So that sounds very complicated. But you gave the inaugural Da Vinci School of Managerial Leadership lecture just a short while ago, and that's how I came to know about you. And your lecture was entitled Individuality and Anarchy. Is that right?
Anarchy and individuality.
I knew I'd get something wrong in there. But yeah, I think these are probably concepts that frighten a lot of people. When you say anarchy, a lot of people just see chaos and disorder.
Mm.
That's not the anarchy you're talking about.
Well, it may be part of that, because it depends on how we define disorder. And as we could see, disorder is potentially something that can be embraced by many people. But I think in essence, I want to anchor anarchy in the notion that it's about self-governing systems and voluntary engagements. If self-governing and voluntary engagement implies the distancing of the individual to what is hierarchically and structured, then that is a possibility.
Now, this idea of individuality, because we can get back to anarchy in a second, but individuality, when the Enlightenment tradition took place in, or started to take place in Europe, it very quickly diverged into a sort of English idea of what being liberal, being liberated was, and a more continental idea of what that was. And those two concurrent streams of the Enlightenment had very different views on individuality. The English school emphasized individuality, am I right? And the continental was more of a collective idea of where we could go as a species and what mattered philosophically.
Well, I think if you look at it from a philosophical point of view, I would argue that the continental approach or idea was a more systemic understanding of reality, that I do exist as an individual because of others, almost similarly to what we know, which is within the African context, I am because you are, but I must be for you to be. So there's a very strong notion of individuality within the understanding of Ubuntu. I'm just not sure that we are talking about it in eloquent terms, and whether we even allow the African people to talk about what Ubuntu means. We tend to look at it from a Western perspective, and why I want to say Western, because we want to look at Ubuntu as a collective, but not necessarily looking at it as a collective and an individual perspective.
Well, it's also been bastardized. I mean, yes. Politicians have used it to obfuscate and to deny personal responsibility and accountability for the individual.
Well, and talking about that, if you look at the English tradition and very much the part surrounding the British Empire, the individuality was also bastardized because it was almost translated into a hierarchical power system. So the stronger the individual I am, the more powerful I became in terms of structuring society. Not in terms of freeing society and opening it up to more ideas, but structuring it, almost closing in on itself and say, this is the truth.
And that's why you like anarchy.
Well, I think indeed the notion of anarchy for me is a very empowering and a very energized construct.
So what is the anarchist's utopia look like? Before we get into your own
ideas.
Well,
I think there's an interesting paradox. I think anarchists do not subscribe to any utopian idea.
All right, so what is the ideal
And even
situation?
To any vanguardism, because anarchy is not meant that you would become part of an elite trying to do something for the masses. But anarchy is rather about developing an ethnographic understanding of the people in their deepest sense of who they are, their values, their rhythms, their understandings, And then in that understanding, giving it almost back as a gift to society in engaging with what the people want.
But if you don't have these structures, and I don't mean to start with an argument with you, but if you don't have these structures that we consider important in civil society, and even in a statist system, how do you implement these things in any meaningful way? Because there are individuals who will contribute, and there are individuals who just won't. And by far the majority of people in the world don't actively partake in civil society. They don't actively partake in the discussions around what kind of a world they want to live in. They don't even necessarily speak up when it comes to what they themselves are and stand for.
I wonder if we take the analogy of the family as a system, whether we would argue that in a family system, there would be individuals who also don't care for the family. And you may say, indeed. Well, I would say ideally, in a family system, which is a close-knit, self-regulated system, ideally, everybody has a role to play. But we have imposed structure on the family system over the past few hundred years. Structures that says, well, for you to be a good husband, you must do X, Y, and Z. For you to be a good wife, you must do this. For you to be an obedient child, you must do certain things. I think the state of the family is much worse now than ever before, because we've imposed structure on that system. So I want to use that as an analogy.
Isn't there less imposition of structure on a family now than there ever has been? Families are not nuclear. They're not defined by the principles of those exact things that you just delineated now. In fact, you could argue that the family is more liberated from any of that structure than ever before.
I think there are families that have indeed liberated them from those. And they are great families, in my view. They are individually minded. They part of a bigger network. They see themselves part of a broader system. But as a psychologist, I'm very aware that the family structure in broad terms is not in a good state, because people are grappling with the history of structure. So the family, in essence, now in current day, is very confused. Will I go into a self-governing system, respecting the individuality of everyone and working together in a self-regulated way, or will I still impose the tradition? If we look at the macro system of this society that I'm living in, which is South Africa, there's a great call for traditionalism. There's a call to become a tribe. There's a call to respect where we come from. Not because that is necessarily wrong, but it provides the flow of energy into a different direction than what I think it should be, that we should rather think of us becoming a more cooperative space where, because we are enlightened, if we are, that we all have a knowledge, not just right. Some of us, but all of us.
This presupposes that every person has a contribution to make, and this presupposes that all people have equal talent to give in that system.
I want to say it does presuppose that everybody has a contribution to make. I don't care whether it's equal. Everybody has got something to contribute. As we are structured now,
we have 17 million people on social welfare in South Africa. These people are not making a meaningful contribution, certainly in terms of the economy. If they are helping to grow their rural community or to look after children because parents might have died and they're the grandparents and they've taken on extra responsibilities, that's all good and well. But that is certainly not helping society to move forward, because these people aren't able to emancipate themselves.
Well, I think the 17 million people, sadly so, are playing an important role politically. I'm saddened by the fact that we're not utilizing the energy of the 17 million people.
So what role?
Because
what
they role do have they a contr- well, they are takers from society, because we framed them to be takers. But that doesn't mean they are only takers. So the fact that people, and I work with some of those people, the fact that they take from society, when I sit down with them and I talk to them and try to understand what sits behind that, well, they're terrified at the same time by the fact that they are taking so much by society. Because even in their own mind, they appreciate that they are vulnerable. At the same time, they're also gullible because they said, give me more. But they're vulnerable in the sense that they know that they're dependent on somebody up there to direct their life. That's a very disempowering position to be. So you asked the question about, do we need structure in society?
Yeah, I mean, this argues against your idea of individuality and anarchy. Now, don't get me wrong. My own personal feelings on this are probably closer to yours than I'm letting on. But I'm trying to play devil's advocate here because it's something I grapple with every day. And I don't want this to get too philosophical because we'll probably lose a lot of people through the course of the discussion. But if you're following now, what Prof. Anderson is saying is that this is that there it isn't dichotomous. It's probably somewhere in between. Mm-hmm. But we need to bring a whole lot more of what you're talking about because that's completely absent from the current situation. The idea of individuality is repugnant to politicians because it means that you as an individual have agency, which counts them out because they like to collectivize us. The idea of anarchy is anathema to statists. Statists are people who want the government to take care of everything and for the individual's rights to be suspended in favor of the majority or worse, everybody, however you classify that. Where do you find this middle ground where we're able to accommodate those 17 million people who effectively are victims of statism and probably don't want to get out of statism because the world outside of that is too scary for them?
Well, on the last one, I want to say, I think many of them want to get out of it. But yes, have they been paralyzed? Have they been prevented from developing mechanisms or ways of getting out of that big black hole? No, they haven't. So there is a challenge. It's an enormous challenge. And I appreciate the fact that we say it's a both-and situation. So if we take my views on what is reality, and we continue taking reality as a known space where I, through my analysis and through my categorization, can be in charge, the status quo will continue and worsen. Because through that statism and through that hierarchy and through that structure, we will bind more people into saying, don't worry, it's not that bad, I will look after you. And we can mesmerize people with that.
Yeah.
If we take a view...
And a lot of people, my point is just that a lot of people are comfortable with that. They might not be happy, but they believe that that's probably a better scenario for them than to be left to their own devices. Because left to their own devices, they're absolutely lost and they'll be swallowed up.
But here's the paradox. So the same system that we're talking about are reaching out in radical transformation. Interesting the word, radical transformation. To say we need to get people to take charge of their futures by becoming more entrepreneurial and invest a lot in small and medium enterprises. That's then paradoxical. Because if you talk that language, you are on the other side of reality, the flip side, which talks about the unknowns, the complex and the chaotic, where you probe and where you put positive energy in the system and be innovative in what you do as a counter towards the known reality where everything is controlled. So what I find fascinating is that in the South African context, we are playing with both those realities. There's a reality of the 17 million and what's associated with it, a known reality controlled and analyzed. And there's an unknown reality through radical economic transformation that postulates more, we must get the individual to rise up to their own expectation.
Which do you think the government currently espouses? I mean, do you think our government is more of the, these 17 million people, we've got to deal with them, let's just keep them beholden?
I'll be honest with you, in my engagement with the governing party, they would like to have a both-and situation, very aware that we can't continue with the 17 million the way we do and let that number rise. And at the same time, we can't not say we don't have enough entrepreneurs and we only depend on the large corporates. So from that socioeconomic point of view, my sense is that there's an interest to embrace the both and. But it's not just a project. There is also philosophical underpinnings that talks to the notions of individuality, of what is a society, of what is anarchy. If you look at a society, be it like Christiana in Denmark, there is an anarchist society which is working for the last 5-6 decades.
How does it work?
Totally self-regulated, independent, no services from government.
Explain,
do not participate in any government activity.
It's an island.
Well, it's part of Copenhagen. It's in Copenhagen.
Mm-hmm.
It's a suburb. But it's totally self-reliant. Now, I'm not saying we must now get little enclaves of people being, in that sense, self-reliant. I'm saying society can be more self-reliant.
But then what we'll end up with, and I don't know whether it would be good or bad, it would probably be good for the people who can self-regulate and self-govern, and not good for the people who are dependent on those people's money. Because the same people who are productive in society, in an unequal, imbalanced society like ours, will probably be the people who will pick up the reins and try to regulate and govern themselves. And the vast majority of people who are not able to participate formally in the economy will continue to just do what the state tells them and hope that the state will hand something out to them. If we did this in South Africa, what we'd end up with is a bunch of Gulf estates filled with rich people, mostly white, who would have a sort of self-governing thing. They'd have stupid rules like you can't build your house out of these bricks and you can't paint it this color. But more or less, they'd run their own services. They'd be able to decide their own laws for speed inside and out. They'd be able to decide whether they wanted a shopping mall opposite them or not. That would be fine for those people. Outside of that, there'd be huge dissatisfaction. We'd create a more unequal society, don't you think?
It will, but that does not, for anarchist or anarchist belief, that would not be the way to go. So anarchist belief is not about benefiting the few as opposed to benefiting all. For anarchist society, it's about benefiting all, because self-regulation happens through cooperative engagements where decisions are made for the benefit of the greater good.
But that sounds statist. Where decisions are made for the benefit of the greater good. That sounds to me like a structure.
Well, it's not where you see these societies. If you like the one I referred to in Denmark,
Christiana,
that's not a status society. What could make it, why it's got tendencies to become that, is because of the inequality of society. So we've got a lot of work to do as society, not just in South Africa, but this is where we are.
But Ben, can I just ask you this?
Yeah, but I just want to make this point.
One person from the outside
moves
into Christiana.
Yes.
It shifts the entire equilibrium. And every time someone moves in,
and that's reality,
it changes the equilibrium.
And that's reality.
And therefore, it becomes a threat to that very, very fine balance.
To give an idea, the misuse of drugs was huge in Copenhagen, and they banned those people. The community of Christiana said, come to us. And they've worked with those drug addicts.
All right,
and created a very equal society.
Let me explain in a more absolute sense. If 300 Muslim refugees from Syria moved into Christiana in Copenhagen, there would be massive social ramifications.
There will be definite change. It will.
And would this anarchist system cope with that change?
Well, it would want to cope with it. Because I want to say, when the drug addicts moved into Christiana, it wasn't because it was easy. They struggled to deal with it. But they committed and said, we will deal with this because we talk about us being open and self-regulated and respecting individuality. What the anarchist society will not accommodate is if there's any tendency to take charge. Because in an anarchist society, I don't want to convince you of anything.
Right, but Islam as an ideology, like most of religions
ideology. All religions are ideologies.
They're authoritarian.
Yes.
So they want to come in, and the only way that they can get their way and the only way they can tolerate everyone else.
So theoretically, we could argue if that is what they want to do, they want to capture that free society. Mm. That free society will probably, after attempts of trying to engage, will probably reject them. It's possible.
So they'll end up on the outside. But this is what worries me about talking about South Africa, and again, I don't want us to get too theoretical here, because there are very specific things I want to talk to you about in terms of education. But these are all, apart from Christiana, are there good examples of a much larger scale application of this sort of thinking?
Well, I think in the research that I've done, you get communities in Africa. You get communities in Madagascar. So anarchy societies have been fairly small, you could argue. They haven't taken the world by storm, and people have aligned to it.
Well, because they're not organized and structured around
the whole nations. And I want to say, and that's almost okay for me, because anarchists don't have any intention of converting people to anything. It's just that there are people that has a need to live an optimum life in that space.
Oh, absolutely. And
now,
you could argue from your point of view that the nation state is probably an outdated idea.
Yes. Well, that's where I actually want to go to. I just don't think we appreciate how we are still living the remnants of what has happened hundreds of years ago. And that we are still, I mean, why do we still need governments? Or why do we need to be governed the way we are governed? Why? Do we ask that question?
Of modern technology,
yes.
Where there are countless ways that we can make our...
I mean, and if you look at governance, just the way higher educations have been governed in what has happened in the last 12 months, 24 months at higher education institutions. Well, I must tell you, those students have become self-governing of their academic pathways to a large extent.
Do you think that's better?
I don't think it was necessarily harmful.
A lot of people are saying that higher education is in crisis at the moment, that there isn't, that the value of higher education has been diminished by all of this. Do you agree with that?
I don't necessarily agree with that. The fact that I may not have had the exam as was determined 3 years ago may sound a bit chaotic. So I will admit the chaos that was in this. But that doesn't necessarily mean, if we see it as a transition, I'm not necessarily sure that we transition to something worse than where we were.
But you sound like a relativist.
Well, things could be relative.
No, don't say that. That's a terrible answer to a very simple question. Come on. You know, I know you. I know you're an academic.
I think we must be careful to define things and say, well, this is the rule and this is the definition.
No, but there
and
must,
therefore we must structure it a way that life is energy in abundance.
But hang on, sure, of course, this is all good. Diamandis, you're talking
about. Yes.
Okay, but then let's just bring it back to what is true. I mean, there has to be some yardstick, some measure for progress, for civilization. Mm-hmm. For society to be positive or negative. If everything's relative, you don't have those in place. You sound like a postmodernist who then just wants to break things. And that's where anarchism gets its bad reputation, from precisely this kind of leftist thinking.
Well, if breaking things is part of moving in a different direction, I'm not sure that's necessarily bad. If we, in our structured space, were so great... How did it happen in this society that I've got 17 million people bowing before me every day and saying, please give me something?
No, you raise an important point, but I don't think that destroying the system that we've got is necessarily going to be the answer to that. I mean, what do you...
I don't want to promote destroying the system. From an anarchist point of view, I believe working within the system. In the anarchist world, you would say... Be so eloquent in how you work with the autocratic systems in the system that democratically they will embrace what you bring.
But you seem to, this is very frustrating for me, forgive me. I'm not immersed in the world that you are, and perhaps these arguments are made more sensible by you having a counterpoint to someone who's perhaps more educated than I am in this respect. But this is frustrating me because you seem to want to have your cake and eat it. You are speaking about individualism and anarchism as very theoretical ideas, And when you need to make them more practical, you're quite happy to bring in a little bit of statism or a little bit of democracy. Surely that's not a sensible way to argue. I don't know what you mean anymore. I don't know what your integrity is.
Well, my view is, I think we've got a view that anarchism, as you made the comment, want to break things.
That's the notion of everything being relative, mm-hmm. and this postmodernist mm-hmm. stuff mm-hmm. that is largely the remnants of failed Marxism, mm-hmm. that these things imply mm-hmm. that anarchism mm-hmm. must be a destructive process. Mm-hmm. I think we both agree that anarchism mm-hmm. can be a positive process. Mm-hmm. It can be a constructive process. But to get the individual to the point where they have agency, mm-hmm. to get the society to the point where people can self-govern mm. is a very difficult process. It's a tough ask. I don't know that we have the answers to
it. It is complicated,
questions.
And therefore my reference to an ethnographic engagement.
What do you mean by ethnographic?
Well, ethnographic engagement would be, can I get to who you are? Can you help me?
We don't have time.
Well,
there's 17 million people out
there. I can say yes to that. But because we never spend time with understanding who people are, we've created something that is fairly problematic.
No. Now you're taking away the agency completely from those people when you say we've created something.
Well, we've created something. The elite has created something. It's very difficult for those 17 million people.
If you consider me a part of the elite, I don't know whether you do or don't. You do?
Yes.
Okay. I have never gone out and removed someone's agency out of purpose and volition. I've never been in a rural environment where I've decided these people are my peasants and derived any kind of benefit directly from them. If anything, I pay for 16 or 17 people that I don't even know. I don't know that is my creation, and I'm not prepared to take responsibility for it.
Well, I think it's the way I'm very aware of how I speak and how we speak, because how we speak can take agency away from people.
Give me an example.
And I don't have an answer to that. In my engagement with people who you may say is not part of the elite, I am very frustrated at some point and challenged how to engage, because I'm aware that my engagement, in a sense, takes away certain agency from people who is not part of my social system.
But this is a soft bigotry of low expectations. This is you saying that you have the power through language to affect these people in a negative way. But you're again removing their agency from this, that they could quite easily counter your argument or your language with their own.
Well, I'm saying both have power.
Well, then why aren't those 17 million people taking some of their power back?
I don't think
we've created an environment which makes it possible. You even admitted that yourself.
I don't think we can say they've not done it. But as it plays out on a day-to-day base, I think it's quite obvious that we could say it's not working.
I agree with you. But what better system? You see, you're talking when it comes to coming up with something better, and I'm not criticizing your philosophy here.
Well,
I'm saying pragmatically.
Let me be pragmatic.
Okay.
Stats South Africa has just revealed some time ago that there is about 110,000 people who make out the top level of the elite. People who earn 60,000 and more every month.
That's, by the way, hardly an elite position to be in.
In terms of South Africa?
Yeah, okay.
That's determined as elite.
Yeah, sure. Our standards are low.
So, 110,000 people. Of those 110,000 people, there's an interesting social dynamic. Mm-hmm. I think 54,000 and 55,000 is black people, mm-hmm. as we use it in South Africa, and the other half is white. So, at least we now know that the notion of white capital is problematic, because if you take the pension funds into play, then there is not white capital anymore. But back to the comment, I would like to see.
And of course, it removes the idea that the state is not the main actor, which it absolutely is.
Which it is. So it's that kind of reality check on the one hand, but also if we can take the 110,000, of which the elite, I would think it would be magical if the 110,000 could almost have a lechotla and say, guys, so do we want to do something to society, not to the 17 million? What kind of society would we like to facilitate? And who are all the stakeholders that we can involve in creating that society? I don't know where it would lead, Cliff, but I don't think we've had that honest debate. I would love to sit down with people who are not in my space.
But you suppose that in 110,000 people, you might be able to reach some kind of consensus or majority opinion? You don't think you'd have schisms?
You will have schisms, but we must ask ourselves, it's like being on a ship. If there's an iceberg coming closer to you, you can have the schisms.
Well, let's take recent political events into consideration. Isn't there a consensus by most of the people on the ship, except for the captain, that we need to do something to alter our course fairly radically right now? Don't you see that happening?
I think
don't
society says...
A strategic alliance of very disparate...
And I see some of that coming out. If you look at the adverts that was taken in the last run of newspapers from corporates, I mean, that's the 110,000 coming closer. I'm still not sure that we're bringing all the stakeholders from different levels close. I hope we can get to that point. That's why we hear people talking about a new CODESA. But if I listen to what's happening in the public speak, what's the narrative? There's a political narrative. I'm saddened. This morning even, I listened to a radio show and I wanted to phone in and say, could we have a social?
Yeah, but you were probably listening to tripe like Eusebius
McKeyser. Could we have a social anthropological...
In which case you have only yourself to blame. If you listen to that claptrap, you deserve
it. But could we have layered at least over this political stuff a more honest discussion about what is happening in me?
No, but we can't, because people don't have... There is very low self-esteem in South Africa.
Well, I said yes to that before. So what are we doing to opening that up?
I'm on your side, Ben.
But we must open that up. I must be... And I'm careful to say we must. But something must happen in this very divided society to say... If we are agreeing that we are humans at the end, and that we want food, and that we want families, and that we want partners, and that we want... Let's agree on what do we want. I wonder if we won't have a different debate.
We would.
But we're having debates around political power.
Agreed. And this is where you and I are really on the same team. I think that everything in this country is political because it keeps things... just far enough away for it to not be personal and just close enough for you to be able to get angry about it. But nobody's dealing with self-esteem problems, with the breakdown of the family, with higher education being in crisis. And higher education, a thing that you are well-versed in and which I want to talk to you some more about, higher education is an elite business.
It has become an elite business.
In this country, it's absolutely an elite business. And
in the
1500s, the very top of the pyramid gets to go to university.
In the 1500s, Oxford spent their time, evenings, without electricity, by bringing education to coal mine workers. That's university.
And that happened in the 1500s.
That's university. That's the intention of a university, to open up society, to collect the new ideas and define them in new alternative ways.
And it's possible to do that now because of technology, right?
It's possible. Huh. It's possible. So the notion that that universities have morphed into elitist spaces is sad. It's very sad.
But even the conversations that go on at universities must trouble you sometimes, because there is a narrative and there's a political agenda within academia.
Well, remember this history of the universities in South Africa. We've got government universities, of which is governed by government. We talk about freedom of speech, but in the apartheid times, the universities were very, very beautifully governed by the political order of the day. today, it may not be just governed by one political entity, but by multiple political entities, because we have moved on that trajectory to more voices, but it's not politically governed. You vote at university for leaders in terms of political alliance, affiliation. That's not the university that I have in mind.
How does your university look?
Well, our university is an open space where there is an awareness of not to be aligned to a specific group of people, so to speak. But an awareness that reality is complex, it constitutes known and unknown and knowable and chaotic entities, and how are we going to facilitate an innovative learning pathway that we will send people away, graduates, and that graduates would have one key element, appreciating how not to create disorder. And what I mean with disorder, not creating disorder, I mean not creating imbalance, but constantly managing the flow of energy between the known and the unknown realities.
How do you feel in a world where you would describe yourself as an individualist and an anarchist? Mm-hmm. How do you feel about the free market?
Well, I almost tempt to ask you, is the free market free?
What do you think?
Well, I don't think it's free. There's a lot of power behind the free market.
You mean manipulation?
Yes.
Yeah. I'm sure that everyone would agree. Even the...
So the idea of the free market, I can subscribe and I align to it. But then it must be free. But it's not free.
What are your feelings about...
So free means I must give away that power. I must not be worried and manipulated at the back end. I mean, free market in South Africa, in the agricultural sector, we see huge manipulation. We can have long debates around that, but there's huge manipulation. And then we talk about a free system. That's not true. It's not true.
How do you factor the perfect free market, or let's say an approximation of the perfect free market, into anarchy?
Well, I think anarchy could allow a free market. Because it would allow people to compete in terms of their own terms, but in respect of other. But not try to manipulate things. Because anarchy, in its deepest sense, appreciate the systemic engagement of reality. That there's ebb and flow, that there's equilibrium and disequilibrium, that things will work and things won't work. But that we don't get into a structured reaction and say, well, because things are not working, I'm going to manipulate it to work. It allows it to go through those ebb and flows, because that's life. I'm not always on top of the world, but I am at times on top of the world and at times I'm not, but that's life. We're trying to create a perfectness, and I'm sometimes worried whether our colonialist past and philosophically as embedded in Plato and Aristotle, whether we appreciate the remnants from that we want to create an utopia, a perfect world. There isn't a perfect world.
No, we'll only ever get an approximation of it.
Yes.
But I think life is better now than it's ever been.
I think life is almost great as opposed to where we were.
Yeah, so I think we agree on that there's a general steady progress towards what's perfect.
But therefore interesting that now we get to a point from a socioeconomic political view, almost a tendency to say, what are we going to do about this? And I want to say, don't try to control it. Don't try to control it. Let the system, let the energy move it. We've come a long way. Allow it to continue moving.
And what if it results in an even more unequal society? If we don't influence it positively, if we aren't
able
to create...
Let's just influence it.
Okay, but let's say there's structure involved. And you have to build political structure, economic structure, social structure, hierarchical stuff. Let's say that has to happen in order for you to force the positive change. And you decide not to. You err on the side of anarchy, and it goes the wrong way.
Okay.
And it turns out to be a more unequal society. What will you say then?
Well, I want to first argue, from an anarchist point of view, I don't necessarily see that's the only way of creating momentum towards where we've come from and where we could go to a more engaged, more free, more equal, more empowered society. Because if we do the notion and say there must be political, the structure must be politically, economically, and then socially, I almost want to tip it around and say, from an anarchist point of view, I probably wanted to pose, let's look at it socially, with appreciation that there's economic and there will be political, but not necessarily in the order of political, economic, and social, but the other way around.
Okay, this presupposes that there's a certain nature to humanity.
Yes.
What do you believe that nature to be? Because I find myself vacillating between the two all the time. Mm. On some days I feel humanity is imbued with a natural goodness, a desire to collaborate and cooperate, to do what is mostly good in any given situation. And then on other days I feel that we are selfish primates who are tribal and backward, and we cling to outdated nonsense, and we like prejudice, and we like the idea of us and them. And then I get disappointed and depressed. Where do you lie on this?
Well, I can say I can experience both in my engagements. So as if I put my therapist hat on, I can engage with a person who killed somebody, who I can honestly say who I can care for. So it depends on what is the context of what happens.
But you're assuming, you said social first, then economic, then political. You're assuming that there is a basic goodness and a desire to collaborate and a desire to improve.
Yeah, I experience people. With people that we would say are imprisoned, therefore by society identified as being bad. Mm-hmm. My engagement with people in that space is that they're not just bad. Their badness was not very eloquent, we may say. We get blue-collar crime. That's very eloquent. And we will still hail them as our leaders. So that's where the relativity perspective maybe become more nuanced. But my experience is, if you sit down with people, there's a humanness in all of us that I wish we can just embrace a little bit more, because I want to believe it will take us to a more open society. It doesn't mean it's going to solve everything. If you look at the Eastern trends, where the notion of the both and is more pronounced than in our societies, I see more of that. It's less about me, it's about us. But I think in the historical pathway that we came, often as European descendants, the us has become a very elitist us. It's not an us that embraces everybody. It's an us that says, if you paint your rooms yellow and black, then we can talk. But if you paint it red and blue, we are not engaged. And I think that's the problem that I see, is that we struggle to appreciate the diversity amongst who we are as individuals. And that we believe we can move forward by aligning diversity into a more uniform space, because we believe if we got that focus, and then we can have control.
But then the ultimate problem for someone who talks like this is that you have to harness the collective creativity of this diverse crowd. And that is sometimes a difficult thing to do, because
it is difficult, but
in
it's
their
possible.
Diversity, they have different ideas of what is good, bad, necessary, unnecessary, positive and negative, right?
I want to say I agree with you, but I want to give you a few examples.
Right.
If we look at in harnessing, so the word harnessing I can relate to, but if you look at the work of a guy like Stephen Shimshovich,
not familiar.
The view currently is, in the art world, if you want to buy art, you go to an art dealer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Shimshovich has changed that around in a similar way that Uber has changed the whole notion of transport around Kalanick. So if you look at those, if you look at the Google example, if you look at what Zuckerberg have done, if you look what Bill Gates have done, just to mention but a few, they've all harnessed the diversity into a meaningful engagement. But there's not a lot of structure. There's not that focus on power. There's not that focus on hierarchy. So those are very subtle examples for me that wants to indicate that society is going to a next phase, not necessarily of collaboration, but of cooperation. I'll give of me and you'll give of you. not because we like each other, but because from a almost conceptual point of view, we respect each other. We come from a past where we focus so much on liking each other that I forget to see you. Because if you haven't painted your rooms yellow, then we can't talk. And I said, no, maybe there must be something interesting in painting my room yellow. But I must explore it. I must open my mind to that.
So it's these a priori decisions about what we value and what we don't. And you say that they're artificial.
Yes.
All right. I need to know what you think higher education is going to feel like, look like, sound like, be like in another 5 years. You've been a part of several important commissions and committees that have discussed this ad infinitum. I'm sure that the individuals in this case are also important, but we'll leave Angie Motshekga out of it for a moment and Bladen Zimande. What do you think higher education should be and could be in South Africa?
I'm careful to say how it would look like because, so I'd rather just talk and how I think we could think about education in the higher space.
All right.
So there are a few ideas. The one is we talk glibly about innovation, but I hope that academics, administrators, and students and industry alike will collaborate with each other to make a transition to create a more innovative learning engagement.
Right.
So that we will become more, almost less coordinating and specialist focus, but becoming more collaborative and cooperative in engagement. So there's not the academic specialist anymore, but the academic professor becomes the main facilitator of a learning journey. Almost just facilitating, not becoming the guru anymore. I think if we want to continue being the specialist and only the specialist in our little world, I'm not sure we're going to get new perspectives on academics.
Hang on a second. Again, you frustrate me because surely the idea of innovation must come from specialization.
I almost tempted to say not necessarily.
I'm not going to design a new kind of bridge unless I am an engineer. I'm not going to design
Why does an engineer need to design a bridge in the future?
Well, because we don't want it to fall down is a good answer.
Well, it will not necessarily fall down. If the guy who's a
sculptor works with paper mache builds the bridge, it will.
There will be definitely pieces that we could argue. If you don't have that specialist knowledge in medicine, they argue that. In architecture and engineering.
This argument does run counter to human progress. Specialization is what got us to this point.
Well, I think that we can debate whether that's necessarily a fact. I think specialization can take you to a very specific place. I'm not sure specialization will necessarily take you always beyond that space. If we look at transdisciplinary engagements, then the notion of specialization, which is disciplinary focused, becomes less relevant. You may almost say you could be a specialist, but if you want to go to the next level, you'll be from a disciplinary point of view, you'll become a transdisciplinary facilitator. So I'm a medical practitioner and I'm a heart surgeon. But to do heart surgery in 20 years from now may become more of a machine learning piece. Than being a heart specialist.
Yeah, and only because of specialization in technology that has made it possible for machines to be able to do that.
But I may not necessarily be the guy who developed the machine to do the future transplant.
Absolutely.
So it's that transdisciplinary engagement. So it doesn't negate specialization, but it just says we mustn't drive specialization as the ultimate goal and the only goal.
All right. What else?
So that's the one piece. But to get there, there are thinking patterns that I think is important that people will have to embrace at university or, for that matter, in any education space. The one is, how do you facilitate the notion of sense-making? Before you start talking to me how to operate on a patient, how do you facilitate the awareness around social intelligence? How do you embrace the notions of media literacy? Therefore, the machine learning pieces that I just referred to. And how do you engage in cognitive load management? Therefore, how do I, as a faculty, share and not protect? We talk about IP. That's, in my mind, a very old-fashioned idea. But IP assumes I'm the specialist, I'm in control. Well, cognitive load management as a future skill says, I want to give it to you. Yeah. I want to give it away.
Free source code.
Whatever you do with
and
it.
Build whatever you want.
Because you're going to give something to me, and as a society, social intelligence, we will all move upwards.
Right.
So those thinking patterns will be able to translate that innovative learning from a specialist to a more transdisciplinary engagement. I think we must also understand developments regarding current work-related, both public and private, thought processes, and the techniques and practices that goes with it. So we must appreciate, am I approaching it from a view that we're a tribe or an institution or a market or a network of professionals? Because if I want to educate you from the view that I'm the specialist, I'm in a sense creating another specialist that will create another specialist and we'll become a nice tribe.
Isn't that what individualists do?
Well, I will hope that's not what individualists necessarily would do. If you look at peer-reviewed articles, so in the tradition, old tradition, if you're not peer-reviewed, you're not respected into the fold.
Mm.
My goodness. So the world is saying if five people peer-review things around the world and they say it's good, then it is good. It may be good, but it's not only when it is good. What has been accepted by industry doesn't necessarily come from peer-reviewed. So you currently get a situation where academics publish in peer-reviewed articles and they're speaking academic language, which makes sense to the academic world, but it has no relevance to the industry.
I agree with you. There are lots of dead ends.
So we'll have to be careful. But again, it's a both and.
But peer review is the scientific method too. I mean, your purpose is to create...
And must it only be the scientific method that will take us forward?
It's certainly taken us this far. And by no means has it done it single-handedly, but it has been, in the majority of cases, the greatest civilizing effect.
So it has brought us this far. We have to now go beyond that.
Of course, but I don't think that by throwing out the scientific method,
It's not throwing it out. It's saying you must combine it. You must combine the tribe with a professional network. Because in that tribe, that peer-reviewed guy says, I will not share with you what I know. I will critique what you tell me, but I will not give you what I think. In a professional network, the dynamics change. So I believe the university of the future will have that added. So it will be an opening up, a broadening
that makes
of
sense.
Perspective.
Right.
I think another piece that I want to say I think is important, we alluded to it earlier. I think academics, whether it's in the natural sciences or the building sciences or the medical sciences, doesn't matter, should talk more to ideological constructs.
Really?
I think there should be a wider debate around matters on what is individuality, what is socialism, what is democracy.
I'd rather not have the pharmacists worrying about that stuff.
I would hope they could worry about that. Because the pharmacist, if the pharmacist has got a more systemic view of reality, we may do different prescriptions differently. I've got pharmacists, there's examples of people being prescribed medicines, especially when you get to the elderly, but they don't have a view outside that channel. So I'm not saying we must now all become anthropologists and sociologists.
God help us, no.
But
if the humanities go any further in their reach, every lecture will be a philosophy one.
But it's interesting, Cliff, if you look in almost, hundreds of years ago, in both the Asian and the European spaces, the Greeks and the Romans, there was a much broader debate around reality than we have today. So we allowed that debate to become the prerogative of a few. I think we must have a wider debate. I must be able to talk to your security guard entering here and say, so what is your reality today? And then he mustn't say, ooh. He must say, well, this is what I'm experiencing. It doesn't matter what it is.
Absolutely.
Because part of the respect that people have for themselves is having a voice. I cannot have a voice if I only know how to make this tool.
But if I go to university to study particle physics,
yes,
I don't need a lecture on philosophy or democracy.
I want to say,
or society.
You may say you don't need it. I want to argue you will benefit greatly from it. You will maybe become just a better, you will still be a particle physicist, but you'll understand the contextual aspects of it in a different way. That's my belief.
And when do you,
I think
when
we,
do you
we
stop
cut
it?
Society.
How do you stop it from becoming political?
Well, I don't think when you go ideologically, it need to be political.
The very idea of ideology is that it must, it consists of a set of beliefs.
All right, but remember ideology and de Trecy, a French guy who started that, I just want to say what was his original definition. I've got it somewhere. Mm-hmm. He said in the 1700s, and if I can, I just can't put my hand on it now, that ideology is a set of belief to a method to provide a foundation for all sciences and to investigate the manner in which humans' thoughts are constituted.
But this is counter.
It's the science of ideas. That's ideology.
No, there can't be such a thing. These are non-overlapping magisteria. Science is concerned with the nature of reality. It's not about a set of beliefs, otherwise it would be a religion.
Yeah. But the idea of ideology as it was in its forming father, which is Destutt de Tracy,
sure,
in during the French Revolution, was a method to understand how humans' thinking process works.
And that's a humanity. That's a subject for the humanities.
Well, he defined it as the science of ideas. So we haven't, I'll give you this benefit credit.
There is no science to ideas.
Well, we haven't developed that. Does it mean it can't exist?
No. But you must decide where it fits here, because it can't be both here. I've let you have both on almost every other argument. It can't be both.
I want to say we haven't developed.
If you talk about the theory of gravity, there are means and ways of proving that your hypothesis is true or untrue. Mm. And it's a peer review, and certain people will spend their entire life in specialization trying to figure, do you see how we've come full circle here? Trying to figure whether it is true or not. That is science and the application of the scientific method. The science of ideas is a humanity, and in that you will have hundreds of old white men arguing for years and years into the future, hopefully many old black men and women and transgender people and children and all kinds of people in the future too. But they will be arguing amongst themselves, and there's no way to prove that one person is right and the other is wrong, except by nasty methods of political extermination, anger, violence, statism, and all kinds of other nasty preconditions that will be arrived at. As a result of these discussions,
we arrived at strange and weird conclusions in the science space. We did strange things over centuries based on scientific evidence of what will be a medical practice. How will you remove a tumor? I mean, there was science and says, no, you must cut out the skull and then you must remove it.
Those weren't scientists.
Well, at that point, they were defined as sciences. So if I talk about the science of ideas, I'm the first to admit we've not invested in it properly. But if I look 200 years ahead of us, I will hope to see the science of ideas taking its rightful position amongst sciences. We haven't done that. We haven't invested enough in it. It has been robbed almost, in my mind, of what it potentially could be. So the fact that it doesn't exist in a true sense, and that we only have almost ideas around it and remnants, that's okay. But I will not want to say, let's not attend to it going forward. I see it as a future that would look totally different. I believe we will get to a world, maybe 100 years from here, where we won't have this kind of conversation, because we may not even use words, because we would have understood how the mind works. And through energy flows, we will engage. But the notion of voice potentially may become irrelevant as we know it today. That's maybe how the humans will engage, almost avatar-like, 200 years ahead of us.
And I would posit that the only way we will get there is by science, not by sitting ruminating.
And I want to say, science of ideas is an unexplored space.
You know what? I do think that you and I would end up talking for hours and hours if we could. And I find a lot of your your takes on things to be extraordinarily exciting. It's rare that I've had the discussion or debate that we've just had with many of my guests, because sometimes it's a very, you know, there's a particular reason that I've brought them in. And I did think we would talk more about higher education. We have, certainly. But I'm very, very interested in the ideas of individuality and of anarchy. And I think you've argued some interesting cases for both. So thank you for your time. I appreciate meeting you.
Well, thanks for the opportunity of sharing my voice.
Sure. Thank you. CliffCentral.com